his insights on benefits in economics, finance, and insurance.
Okay, thank you. Thank the organizers for giving me a chance to bring a new stream to this well-established network. So I'm talking about applications in finance, economics, and insurance. And all the three areas are different, so it's not, they're not the same. And correspondingly, I had the privilege of working with people who are specialists in these areas, and some of them are listed on are listed there. Well, so maybe such questions which you can see on the transparency were faced by the humans maybe for many thousand years, and somehow over a thousand years they approached different ways to solve these questions. But only about 50 years ago, mathematicians start tackling these questions from a mathematical viewpoint. And this led, in the meantime, over 50 years to three Nobel Prizes. So one was given to Gerald Debreu for allocations, and Debreu is also known as the person who introduced the Debreu expectation of random sets. Well, the second group was Robert Aumann, who also gave his name, well, his name was given to the Aumann expectation, and Lloyd Shapley, the famous for allocations and cooperative games. But he also had easily added John Nash to this list and some others as well. So my aim is to show what happened in this whole area over the last 10 years approximately. And in the first lecture, I will tackle mostly economical applications and a little bit of finance. And in the second lecture, I will deal mostly with finance or risk or capital reserving applications, which are more pertaining to insurance, the insurance business. And I will mention some financial networks. Well, so this, because this is recorded, and I'm talking a little bit of finance, so what's important to all these future viewers of this video, don't do this at home, don't try this at home. Well, so it's a financial issues. There are financial issues involved. So this based basically on three and some other papers. And today we'll talk about the first and the third paper and some work in progress, and tomorrow I will mostly concentrate on the second one about risk measures. Well, so let's start with a definition. So the basic definition of a random set, which says that a map from omega, from a probability space, to the family of closed sets of some space, which we assume to be Polish, is said to be a random closed set if some sets of omega associated with this map are measurable events. So in other words, if I have an open set G, then I can always tell if my X hits G or misses G. And it's quite common in the RD to talk about compact sets instead of open sets, but in general spaces there might be not enough compact sets. But it doesn't really make much difference, so I will mostly, whatever I will bring as an example will work fine in RD. Well, so, what are examples? So far, many examples that you have encountered and you have heard in other talks are of the following nature. One takes point process, and the points of the point process build a random set. So it's a support of the point process. Or maybe there are random geometric graphs, so some points are connected, or maybe we construct balls around these points and arrive at the Boolean model, or take lines process, or some random polytopes. So these are structures which are basically point-based, which are constructed from points. And another feature of these structures, they are mostly stationary, but sometimes non-stationarity appears, but they are naturally spread over the whole space. So let's look at some other examples which come from different side, from economics side. So in economics, in microeconomics, it's quite typical to deal with games. And a game of D players has an equilibrium, which equilibrium I don't more there at the moment. So Nash equilibrium, for instance. And this equilibrium may be pure or mixed. Pure if it is 0 or 1, so the player enters the game or doesn't enter the game, or mixed if it is probability of entering. But this equilibrium forms a vector of dimension equal to dimension of number of players. And it's well known that the games might have multiple equilibria. So as a result, the family of equilibria builds a set. And if the game has some random parameters, for instance, there might be random profit shifters which change the profits of particular players. I will come to this example at some stage. Then the equilibrium set of equilibria becomes a random subset of the unit cube. Or another example, typical in economics and econometrics, concerns interval measurements. So if you asked about salary, so people seldom report the exact value, say they, if they even would, they report the bracket. So salary between 10 and 20, or maybe between 50 and 300k. Well, this is not because of lack of precision. This is because even of intentional reporting of interval instead of exact values, sometimes even for anonymity purposes. And this situation is quite different from the situation with lack of precision or interval censoring, which is typical in statistics. Here intervals are inherent and one has to deal with intervals. Or another situation comes from uncertain probability measures. If one is not sure what the underlying probability measure is, one has to deal with a family of probability measures. And because each probability measure corresponds to some random element, the family might correspond to a random set. Well, second source of examples is finance. So it's well known each asset has two prices, the bid and the ask price. And the bid price is lower than the ask price. So there is a price margin for the price interval for each asset. So this picture, which you see here, shows it in 2D. On the x-axis, you see cash, and on one axis is the amount of asset bought for one unit of cash. So if one has two units of cash, there will be twice as much asset that one can buy. If there is less cash, there will be less units of assets. So this is the set on a plane which is a cone. And this is the case for one asset. In the multi-asset settings, there appear much more complicated random cones, which are the subject of Kabanov's model of transaction costs. And this is a typical model for currency exchange. If one has a bunch of currencies, then obviously for each currency there is a bid and ask price, the price to change it one way or the other way. And these currency transactions might be simply complicated, and they are described by such cones. We'll come to this in due course. Or maybe another trivialized example, which I saw once in my Scottish time, when I was in a grocery shop, and there was an offer: if you buy carrots, you get potatoes cheaper. And so these are two assets, and the purchase of both of them leads to discount. So as a result, if there were no link save discounts or link discounts, then one would see a full rectangle. The discounts on simultaneous purchase of several assets cuts the corners, or probably some corners, because this corner corresponds to simultaneous purchase, and this is for the sale of the two assets. Well, so here you should have seen, if this were not a video recording, here I would have put a picture of a large financial network which joins the major financial players in the world, like the banks and maybe some other companies. But now you can simply exercise your fantasy and imagine here you see really huge networks which involves the most American European banks and non-European banks, and with flows of money between them. Now here's a simplified variant of the same picture. And in this simplified variant, you see a small network which consists of some holding company which may be located in Bermudas or who knows where. And it has two subsidiaries. And subsidiaries run insurance business, which some run life insurance, some run non-life insurance. And there is some junk part, which collects some junk assets. And some run reinsurance. And this small network is called the group. So tomorrow you will see a real picture of the Allianz Group, which is much larger, but which was not copyrighted. Well, so it's and the objective then is to look at, because otherwise the natural question is, where is geometry? The network is not geometric, it's a graph, but geometry is lost. Geometry comes from the possibility of intragroup transfers. Like the company which runs non-life insurance is normally in profit, the subsidiary, the part, normally in profit, and currently the life insurance is in distress. And the non-life insurance part might promise to transfer some amount of money to the life part if needs arises. So this money flows between the parts of the group, between the group members, so within the agents, really make this whole story geometric. So let's make it even simpler with two agents, A and B. The regulator, so it's normally governmental institutions, require each financial agent to set aside some capital reserves. And these capital reserves are needed to secure the uncertain results of financial transactions. So somehow, so the agent, after all, remains afloat with some probability, more than substantial probability. And so what normally happens? The regulators at the moment require both A and B to reserve some particular amounts of cash and freeze it, so put it aside, take it from the operation, which is not really a good thing to do. But the agents might decide to help each other, and so might decide to put really legally binding promises to transfer some amounts of money in case, just in case. And then the question is how to evaluate these promises. What kind of capital should they set aside? Clearly, if they were the same company, one should simply take the sum of two assets. But they are not the same company, and it's not possible to transfer the money from the bankrupt company to because it will not be feasible in the end of the day. And the family of allowed transactions is a random closed set on the plane. It's random because it depends on the terminal position, it depends on terminal exchange rate, it depends on lots of things at the terminal time. Like in this picture, the terminal capital is C1, C2, and transfers to solvent company is allowed only up to amount of available capital. Like here, the capitals are both positive, so one can go and the first company can transfer to the second one, the whole capital. Or the second company might go all the way to the x-axis. But why do we see the shaded area? The shaded area corresponds to dispose of the assets, which obviously no normal company would do. But one can regard it as paying dividends to the shareholders or simply in any other way, because a considerable advantage of this, one gets a random convex set. And it's much more comfortable to deal with convex sets if it is possible to do it without compromising financial realities, then it's really the right way to proceed. In the second picture, so the second company is in plus, but the first company is in minus, and it can transfer the capital up to that point. This is two-dimensional picture. The real picture, much higher dimension. So now we'll go back to Marx and to the main tool, which is important for the following. This main tool is called the selection. So a random vector is called a selection of a random set if it's possible to realize them both on the same probability space so that Xi belongs to X Lamassoure. And from now on, I will not be talking about the same probability space. Whenever selections appear, so somehow I tacitly assume that they are both realized in the same probability space. So let's not bother about the coupling. The famous theorem by Zwi-Arnstein from 83 says that a measure mu can be regarded, probability measure mu, can be regarded as a distribution of a selection if and only if it is dominated by the hidden probabilities of the random set. And it is interpretation is is really easy, because on the left hand side we see the probability that xi belongs to k. But if xi belongs to k, then clearly the set which contains xi should have intersection with k. So there is no other way. So the right hand side is definitely larger than the left hand side. To do it other way is a bit more complicated, but this is still the main argument remains. Well, maybe the first historical instance of this result, which appears even before the theorem, is the distribution of payoff in coalitional games. So imagine set K is the coalition of players, and phi of K is the payoff that the coalition might receive after the end of the game. And the question is how to split payoff between the players. And in a reasonable way, you know, and most simple and strongest gets everything. So the payoff function of phi is not additive. If it were additive, it would be absolutely easy. But the allocation should be a measure, should be additive. And then the only sensible allocations are given by measures which are dominated by payoffs for all possible coalitions. And this is the famous Bondareva-Shapley theorem, which was proved in the end of the 70s on coalitional game theory. And in this case, the main thing is the existence of the allocation. And it says the allocation exists under some convexity conditions on the payoff function. So one can compare it with the domination condition for mu is less than p, x and k non-empty. So that is absolutely the same. So the right-hand side corresponds to payoff function of a coalitional game. But now let's look at another example of a game which is non-coalitional. And this is, again, a famous game from microeconomics, which was used really many times in econometrics literature. For instance, to model airline market or office supply chain market. So imagine there are several office supply chains which compete on the same market in each of the states, like in the USA. And each of these agents receives a profit pi j, which is given by some constant, times what happens with the other agents. So a minus j is the action of other players. Epsilon j are profit shifters. So theta j is negative, because if other players decide to enter, then a minus j is 1. 1 will be multiplied by some negative constant. So as a result, the profit decreases, which is perfectly reasonable for such market entry game. And the aim of this game is to estimate, the aim of this of the econometrician is to estimate thetas based on observations of the game, like from the airlines in each of the major airports, one observes that airline A runs the main business, or airline B, or maybe sometimes both, or maybe in some places not nobody. So they observe the equilibrium. Well, the equilibrium is multiple. Well, set of mesh equilibria for this game is a random set, and it looks like this. So it depends on the profit shifters, which are, say, jointly Gaussian. So like, if the profit shifters are serious, so epsilon is really positive, a strong positive, then pi j is positive for both players. They both will play the game. They both enter the market. If profit shifters are negative, then none will be there. And the most interesting part is in the middle. If this Gaussian variable lies between 0 and minus theta, then the equilibrium is multiple. Either player might enter, or they might decide that with a probability they might toss a coin and decide to enter or not to enter. So, in a sense, one might observe the point 1-0, the airline A enters the market, but it's not clear if it's 1-0 comes from this area or maybe it comes from that area. And the way how the nature chooses the first, the second, or the third is not possible to model. So it's not something that is subject to modeling. So really one has to allow all possible variants. And so for simplicity, let's work with pure strategies only. So the econometrician observes the frequencies of nobody enters, the first enters, the second and above. And so these frequencies are basically the distribution of a selection of a random set S of epsilon, which is a subset of the vertices of the unit square. And so this, and the aim is to estimate theta based on this. And now the Archstein inequalities immediately lead to this estimator, which is a set. Which is, in this case, one talks about so-called partial identification. It means that if I increase the number of observations, increase and increase and increase, still it will not give me the point estimator. So the estimator will remain a set no matter how big the sample is. And clearly, well, this is easy to write. Well, to implement is much more complicated, and to analyze is much more complicated, because even in this simple case, there are 18 or a little less to check. And in the most complicated cases, the family of selections is too rich, and it's really difficult to verify inequalities for all k, especially given that this inequality comes with noise and all statistical fluctuations also enter the game. So, just to make a purified exercise of this style, one can think about the following. So, xi has normal distribution mu sigma square. We observe numbers chosen. We have I idealizations, xi 1, xi n, but they're not observable. So the nature chooses xi's which are greater than xi's. And these xi's are observed. How greater? Nobody knows. So what the best, how to utilize this information in the best possible way? So the clue is to use stochastic divination in this case. Well, so the next result concern, which is important in the relation to selections, is so-called Castain representation. So Charles Castain in 77 proved really remarkable result, which says that a random closed set is always the closure of a countable family of its selections. So it's always possible to find xi1, xi n, so countable family of selections which give a random set as a closure. And so this paves the way between the relationships of sets and the subfamilies of LP spaces. So in the following, LP of X is the family of P integrable selections of X. It might be empty, it might be non-empty, because one adds integrability conditions on the selections. So in this result, we don't require any integrability. So all this xi n belong to L naught. So they're simply random vectors, random variables. But if one wants to read a bit more, then one should require a little bit more. But this important side effect, it leads to the definition of the expectation. So assume that L1 of X is non-empty. So X has an integrable selection. So imagine X is a half line from 0 to, say, non-integrable positive random variable. So the right bound of X is not integrable. But still X has integrable selection because 0 is there. So it's the condition is rather weak. And in this case, Talman expectation is defined as the closure of all expectations of integrable selections. It's always convex set bound under weak conditions, so it's Lyapunov theorem on the range of vector related measures. What is important, high moments are not well defined. Try to do variance, well, I wonder what would come out. Well, so there are no immediate definitions of the high moments in this way. But let's again go back to econometrical literature and discuss an example which relates to this. So imagine we have one explanatory random variable x and the response. But the response is interval valued. So it's something that it's inherently interval valued. There is no chance to model it with some standard sum. And now we have this kind of picture. And the question is, how is it possible to explain this picture using least squares, for instance? Well, so which lines are really compatible with these intervals? And clearly, there is a family of such lines. So the question can be posed, which are slopes and intercepts of all lines that are compatible with this picture? But now, let's put it into formal way. So look at the regression model for mean values. Y is a point from the interval. Y capital is an interval. So the expectation of Y should be the intercept plus slope times expectation of the explanatory. This is a standard model. The solution is well known. This is a simplest linear regression model with design matrix in power minus 1 times 2 expectations. But now remember, Y can be there. It's a point from an interval. So it's only known that Y belongs to the interval. So as a result, there are lots of possible values for expectation of Y. There are lots of possible values for expectation of XY. And they are somehow all related between each other. So this is done by, in an elegant way. This was a paper by Molinari and Beristiano. By looking at all possible pairs of Y and XY. If Y belongs to an interval, then all possible pairs build a segment on the plane. And now one needs to take expectation of the first Y and XY, so which are selections of the segment, and they actually form the expected segment. So the identification region, which the words which replace the estimator in classical statistics, is given by the matrix transform of the expectation of the random segment. Well, so again, another exercise, but it's what happens for polynomial regression? Well, so that's again the hint. Will be x, y, x, x square, y. It will not be an interval, it will be a piece of curve in 3D space. Same question is more complicated, how to handle the interval valued x. Because in this case, one has to deal with lots of matrices. And this is not as pleasant, but possible. Now, let's move on to finals. And so for finals, there are also several parts of finals. Well, let's start with option pricing. Well, so what is on the first line? On the first line, there's expectation. And under expectation, F eta minus k. So F is so-called forward price. It's a deterministic part of the price development. So imagine it's the current price. So just it's spot price times zero. Eta is a factor which gives the price change. So F eta can be viewed as the price of an asset after time t, at terminal time. So k is some number which gives a possible price to sell the asset at a terminal time. So if the real price is higher than k, then it's better to sell for k and pocket the difference, f eta minus k. If the price is lower, the option is worthless and there is nothing to do. So it's simply, one can throw it away. And Q, in this case, is a so-called martingale measure that guarantees that the expectation of eta under Q is 1. So it's the easiest possible option. And there is a matching one, so-called put option is the right to sell. Call option is the right to buy, and put option is the right to sell. And this can be expressed in terms of the expectation of a random set, which is a segment that joins points 0, 0 and 1, eta. So the expectation is a sort of like this. And how it is produced? Remember, the expectation for discrete random variable is the sum of possible values of the random variable times the probabilities. So here, for instance, somewhere on the boundary, you see a small segment. This comes from a possible realization of this segment, multiplied by the probability, so scaled down. And some part here is also a segment, which appears if the segment is a little bit, if in case of eta is much smaller than the current one. So this is what is called Minkowski sums of segments. Well, so given the time, I think I can explain it a little bit more about this. And so formally, if one has a segment that joins 0, 0 and 1 eta, one builds a so-called support function. The support function is the supremum of the scalar products of u, a direction, and x for all x from random set x capital. So in this case, because clearly this supremum is achieved either at the one end or the other end, so this will be the positive part. So it will never be less than 0, because 0, 0 is there. So it will be 1 times u1 plus eta times u2, the positive part. So take this formula to the next page, and look what happens if u is minus kf. Then what we have is f eta minus k. So it's a payoff from the call option. So in this case, f is a forward price, and s is a so the product of f eta is a terminal price, and k is so-called strike price. So, and imagine if I changed u slightly, then we get the payoff from the put option. So this means that as long as if I take now the expectation of the support function, it gives me the support function of the expectation. And so this embodies the whole range of options on the market. So one particular side of this story concerns symmetries. So because maybe at this point, natural question arises, what is it for? It's simply a description. So does it give any advantage to over simply talking about option prices as numbers? So the advantage of representing it as a set is, for instance, because one can easily understand the symmetries of the set. And on the plane, it is still can be done without any extra work. But on the multivariate case, the symmetries become much more easier to handle in using the sets rather than simply formulas involving the prices. Like, this is a set which appears in the most standard case for the log normal distribution. So it's so-called famous Black-Scholes model of asset prices. So there are two symmetries of the resulting set. One is a central symmetry, which is called put-call parity in the financial literature. And another one is a line symmetry. And the line symmetry is so-called put-call symmetry, which is much less known, but it's really widely used to hedge some seriously complicated financial products like barrier options. So I simply, if somebody wants, I can do it and I explain it in the break. So for the multi, but really the core of geometry is to handle the multivariate case, to pass to the higher dimension. And in finance, it corresponds to so-called basket products, basket options. So in this case, one has several assets, U not as a cache, and one has assets 1 to D, and the issue is now what one can say about symmetry properties of this expression. And if with respect to the swaps of the coordinates. And this is a big story which somehow relates to exchangeability of sequences or vectors, and it is a big story also. So now in the remaining part I will talk about models of transaction costs. So this is another, you can now switch on if you lost the track so far. So it's a new story. Well, now I'm talking about time. So not there's two time moments now and at the end, but really time now is changing from zero to t, is discrete. It's well known it's not possible to handle transaction costs in continuous time. Because then it will continuous time will inevitably lead to infinite trading costs. So the time really has to be discrete. And when we have a family of random sets KT, which are convex, measurable with respect to the filtration, contain the origin, and are lower sets. And they don't contain any line. One says there is an efficient friction in this case. So the set describes the positions available at price zero at time t. To understand what it is, let's look at the picture. So there are two currencies, euro and US dollars. And for one, if I am in plus, if I own one US dollars, and I might be in minus for some amount of euros. So the exchange rates are notional, so they are not real exchange rates. And I really exaggerated the relationship. And if I'm plus in 1 euros, I can be in minus for some amount of dollars. So these lines correspond to zero positions. And the area below these lines correspond to positions that are worse than zero, which are available at price zero. And one always sees this kind of structure, the cone, because one can imagine why not the line, why not the half space, half plane? The half plane would be the case if no transaction costs are involved. But really, on each exchange, either US dollars in euros or backwards, one pays transaction costs, and as a result, where should be a straight line drops down to create a sharp angle. Well, so the reflected set, if I now reflect KT, is a family of solvent positions that are better than zero. And these sets are random, and in high dimension they are more complicated, they are complicated cones. And at some stages, these boundaries are no longer lines, they might be curved because of the volume of transactions of involved. So it's more complicated to go to the kiosk and exchange $1 million than just 10. So there are lots of further complications. I'm talking now is the easiest case. Well, and this changes in time. Now, what one wants to do with this? VT is the amount of money, the portfolio, available at time t. So VT has two components. Some amount in dollars, some amount in euros. What is essential? The difference between capital at time t and capital at time t minus 1 should be self-financing. It should be available at price zero. So money doesn't come from nowhere. So really, the difference must belong to KT and be measurable with respect to sigma algebra FT. So this guarantees the self-financing, the feasibility of the portfolio. And now, if I now want to understand what might be reached at time T, then I need to take the sum of such increments. And the sum of such increments turns into Minkowski sums. But this Minkowski sum of subsets of L0 So L naught is really not in any space, and all of these subsets of L naught are closed. The sum of closed sets, but non-compact sets, is no longer closed. Maybe no longer closed. So the closure is lost, and quite even in this simple case, quite some functionalities difficulties appear. So AT is a family of attainable claims at time t. Now, well, in finance, there are lots of no-arbitrage variants of no-arbitrage condition, so which means it's not possible to make some strictly positive amount of money out of nothing. And even more variants of no-arbitrage are in models and transaction cost models. One chosen for this presentation is so-called strict no-arbitrage, which says that the family of attainable claims intersected with a family of solvent positions is exactly zero. So it's not possible to arrive at time t at something that belongs to minus at. Minus at is what lies, what is good. Kt is what is bad, rather. But minus kt is what is good. And so it's not possible to arrive at strictly positive result at any time t. And there are lots of people who contribute on the way. And there is a famous result by Kabanov and also a result of about 2000, which says the following. So let's look at dual comb. So KT is the family of positions which are worse than zero, which are zero or worse than zero. Now, let's look at U as a price. So X represents amounts. So the scalar product U and X will be price of the first asset times the amount plus for the second one. So it will be the total price paid for the whole portfolio if U were the price. And it says, for all portfolios available at price zero, we only need look at those prices that make it negative. So what is available at price zero should have price less than zero after multiplying with price. So these U's are called consistent price system. And the dual cone is the cone of consistent price system. So it's easy to construct. So you take the orthogonal line to this one, so it goes there. An orthogonal axis to that cone and goes over there. So it's a strict subset of the first quadrant. And so the theorem, Kabanov's theorem, says that the strict no-arbitrage condition is equivalent to the existence of a probability measure Q, which is equivalent to an original one, which is typical in finance, and another Q martingale, MT, which evolves in the relative interior of this dual cone of the consistent price system. So this is the rule of relative interior is by far not completely understood by now. So if you get rid of it, so somehow no arbitrage conditions appear, but they become immediately much more pleasant. Well, somehow this, going back to random sets, this paves the way to looking at martingales composed of random sets. So a sequence of random sets builds a martingale if the conditional expectation of xt given fs, which means I am taking all points inside xt, all vectors which belong to xt and which are integrable, take conditional expectation for them, and they build a family of random vectors which really correspond, which would generate a set XS. So this is a martingale property. To appreciate what might go wrong, look at sub and super martingale. Clearly, well, for sub martingale one should go this way. It decreases, for super martingale increases, but they are not transformed to each other by minus. Because adding minus there and there doesn't change the inclusion. So it's immediate problem can appear in the start. Well, now again, because we are so there are several instances of saying because of Austin, in this case because of Austin, I would mention something that is related to somehow, which I feel, but I don't know yet, might be related to the Max plus calculus. And this relates to another concept, which is called the conditional core. This was introduced by Lepinet and myself so recently. And it is the largest. So if A is a sub-sigma algebra, and then Y is the largest A measurable random set, which is a subset of X. Even the existence is not immediately trivial, but it exists. And so let's look at an example. If X is minus infinity to Xi, then the conditional core is the half line, which is bounded by the largest A measurable random variable such that eta is less than Xi. So it's in one dimension, it's easy to understand. Well, so now recall the setting of exchange sets and exchange cones for one asset. So remember, so now everything depends on time t. So the word price is the wrong one, so it's simply asset. Prices should not be there. So the cones in this case are controlled by the change in bid and ask prices. So xt is a sequence of random intervals. So they're simple random sets again, so it's nothing complicated. And the aim is to understand for which sequence of intervals it's not possible to trade, to obtain non-zero amounts from zero investment, positive amounts from zero investment. Well, then this leads to the last slide of today's presentation, which is the theorem with saying that for a single asset with bid-ask spread, then strict no arbitrage condition is equivalent to the family, to conditional core, here in a sort of super Martingale property. So if I take the interval at time t plus 1 and look at all possible points, ft measurable points from this interval, and should be more points than in interval xt. So this is another interpretation. So give a quick snapshot what's going to happen tomorrow. So tomorrow I will mostly deal with the regulatory issues. So I will explain how to reserve. So what actually do the governmental regulators impose on the companies? And they impose in terms of reserving some particular assets, of setting aside particular assets. And also what they're imposing on the networks, on a group of companies, and how to, and where at some stage, I promise that the financial networks appear. That's it for today.
Thank you. Inverse cone,
mm-hmm. that you have, the size of that cone is
bigger if the transaction cost is bigger.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But that's the cone where you have to be in.
Yeah. So one can imagine if there is no friction.
Yes.
This is the line.
Yes.
And the dual cone is the ray. It's a single case. It's a single price case. There's only one price. So in this case, one has here, well, for the dusk, versus this cone becomes a line. Maybe it was wrong to write here K. It should be K star.
Oh, I see. So there's only one efficient.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. There is only one price system. It has to be martingale.
Okay, got it.
It has to be martingale. So it's the classical case. And in this view, it's important to have relative interior. Because, well, so because on the line, when it takes relative interior, it's still the line. But what happens if one goes up, dimension up? Well, it's what is the role of martingales evolving on the boundary? It's by far unclear.
Any other question?
You mentioned some connection with the Max Planck.
Yeah. So my feeling is that this conditional core, like this construction, which is below, must be related to martingales. But I might be wrong, of course. So this is what I simply throw in. Somehow it looks like one deals with it basically with the, so this one can take the family of whole eters which are less than Xi and which are immeasurable, and then take essential supremum. So essential supremum can be defined for non-measurable families, for non-countable families. There is a well consistent definition. And in this case, we'll probably have maximum gain.
Yeah. Okay, there are no further questions.
Yeah, let's thank Ilya for the first part of the lecture.